Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. After a short recess, we are now back on the Zoom line and we are ready for oral arguments in the second case set for oral argument today. That case is number A21-153, In Re the Conservatorship of Julianne Yeager. Counsel, as you know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see on your screen a time clock, which will show the time remaining, counting down from 15 minutes. And if you have the gallery view or some other setting, you should be able to see that clock so that you know how much time you have available. Counsel for appellant, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity. My name is William Toulouse. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Julianne Yeager, the ward and a protected person of this proceeding out of Todd County. The court has before it a transcript of a trial that occurred and a significant information before it. So I will not go through all of those factual details in great length or significance. However, some of those things are relevant to the argument that we're making. Essentially, we're making two arguments for the Court of Appeals that the trial court erred in its decision to grant both grant Presbyterian Family Foundation, who I'll refer to as PFF throughout the proceeding, as both the guardian and the conservator. Now, as part of this proceeding and the appeal, we are not appealing the appointment of PFF as the guardian, but our argument is about the conservatorship, given that at the trial, there was no one else willing to serve as the guardian pursuant to the court records. So before the court, we're making essentially two arguments. And the first of those arguments is that the court ignored the statute that a conservator does not need to be appointed if the needs of the ward and protected person can be handled by less restrictive means. And that's the first argument in our brief. And there was significant testimony at trial in Todd County. I think it's important for the, Wadena County. It's important for the court to understand that Ms. Yeager only moved up to Wadena County late in her life because her daughter, Gretchen Noon, who is willing to serve in these capacities, lived up there. She spent most of her life down in Lyon County in Cottonwood, Minnesota. And so the move and why we ended up in Wadena County is somewhat relevant given that all of a sudden people who didn't know her started making decisions for her. So we're making two arguments. First, that the court ignored that there's less restrictive means available to satisfy the ward and protected person's needs. Specifically, her daughter, Gretchen Noon, was appointed her statutory short form power of attorney. It was a durable power of attorney. She appointed her daughter to act on her behalf. Her daughter was able and willing to act on her behalf as the power of attorney, making a conservatorship unnecessary because Ms. Noon could pay these bills and take care of her finances without a conservatorship in place.
Mr. Toulouse, am I correct? The district court essentially found that arrangement had not been effective in the past. And am I correct that was the finding? And if so, what do we do with that?
I think that was the conclusion, Your Honor, but I don't think it was properly justified in the findings. I think that's the conclusion that the court made. And it's relevant to that. I believe Ms. Noon testified significantly that she had done certain things for her mother, such as getting her taxes organized and paying bills and things like that.
I thought that the testimony was that she had only paid one bill and that she also had not been paying the bill for her care facility. Is that right?
Well, that's a little bit misleading, because the testimony from the ward herself at the trial, which the court ignored, was that she actually had not paid her bill for some time, but it was actually paid in full at the time of the trial. So the reason that this conservatorship and guardianship proceeding began was an unpaid bill with a long-term care facility, of which Ms. Noon was unaware that it had not been paid until the conservatorship was already filed. Once the conservatorship was filed, the ward herself paid the bill in full. And the court ignored that evidence and didn't even address it in its findings, that in fact, the original reason for the whole proceeding was moot at that point, that the bill had been paid in full. The reference was made to social services, the referral was made to social services because of the unpaid bill, which in fact was paid at time of trial. So the less restrictive argument was ignored by the court, because in fact, proof had been made that that there was not a conservatorship that was necessary. The statutory review for the Court of Appeals in this case is an abuse of discretion as to whether or not there were less restrictive means available. And we believe that the trial court ignored Minnesota Statute 524.5-409A in ignoring those less restrictive means, specifically the power of attorney and Ms. Noon's authority as a co-trustee.
So your position, just to be clear, Mr. Toulouse, is that the status quo before the conservatorship order was a sufficient less restrictive means. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And it is because there was some testimony, and I think the court's aware of this, there was some testimony on the difficulty that the ward herself created in dealing with her daughter and other people, including social services, including the long-term care facility that she was at. However, there was really no notification to Ms. Noon that these bills weren't getting paid, that Ms. Jagger herself was difficult to deal with. Had those referrals been made, Ms. Noon could have made sure those bills got paid. So our position is that Ms. Noon, as her capacity as a power of attorney and a trustee, could have handled these without the necessity of a conservator.
What do we make of the testimony and the findings and the subsequent findings by the district court that from time to time, the relationship between mom and daughter was at times deceptive, at other times cantankerous, and that there was a period of time when they were not communicating at all, and that daughter doesn't necessarily have a good grasp on the extent of assets that mom has. And so those facts all taken together, which the district court found based on the testimony, seem to interfere with the potential success of continuing with the status quo. What do we make of those findings?
I'll address the last part of that first. The testimony of Ms. Noon counteracts those findings. She testified at length to all of the assets that Ms. Jagger had and how they were titled. She testified about the trust that was created. She testified about all the properties in Cottonwood, about farm property, about barren land, about bare lots. She testified about all that. So she was aware of that. And so I think those factual findings are incorrect, actually. As for the cantankerous relationship, we don't dispute that. I think that's a fact. And I think that's going to be true of no matter who is involved in the case. And I think that would be true of PFF as well. The second argument that we're making is that the court ignored the priorities of appointment. And in this case, the Court of Appeals is to review that statute, Minnesota 524.5-413 de novo. And the trial court clearly, simply reached a conclusion without justification that it wished to come to, and ignored the priorities. As the court's aware,
Is that really fair, counsel? I mean, when I look at paragraph 14 of the decisions, development statute is expressing that there is a preference for a family member to be appointed as conservator, but then makes a finding consistent with Minnesota law that the best interests of mom are not served by having the daughter serve in the conservatorship, So it does appear to me that the district court did recognize what the priority is. It just doesn't agree with your client's position.
Well, I think one of the key points that the court made is not justified by law. The court made the specific finding that because PFF didn't want to just be guardian, that the court appointed a PFF to both. And there's nothing in the statute that references that, nor makes any reference to any such suggestion in law. And so the court is simply trying to square a round peg into a square hole there, because PFF said they would only do one, both, and not one or the other. The court used that as an incorrect justification to avoid the priorities. And Ms. Noon is clearly the priority appointment here, and the court used its justified it by saying PFF would only do one. There's nothing in law, there's nothing in case law as to make a finding as a basis for appointment of a conservator that they would only do one, would only do both and not one. There's nothing in law that says that. So even if the court made findings.
Mr. Tillis, as a practical matter, I mean, what were the district court's options? Because it seems like if the district court had appointed Ms. Noon as the conservator, I get the sense that Presbyterian Family Foundation would have resigned its position as guardian. Is that, and am I wrong in assuming that they may do that? They have the choice to resign. And well, so anyway, so then where would we be?
Well, we would be back at having to get a different guardian appointed, but we'd at least be following the law. In other words, we wouldn't be ignoring the priority appointment here.
And there'd be no guardian available, right?
Well, at least I don't know. Maybe Ms. Noon then would agree to serve as guardian if that happened. I mean, we're dealing with a speculation there as to who would step up and be a guardian. But that doesn't mean the trial court gets to ignore those priority appointments and make an improper justification for doing so.
Why is it improper for the district court in considering what the best interests of the ward are to consider whether there will be a guardian appointed as well, especially when the district court says it strongly believes that she needs a guardian? Why is that legally improper for the district court to make that conclusion as part of the best interest determination for the ward?
Because it's not justified under the statute. And it's improperly applied according to the priorities.
I was about to ask Mr. Tillis. I mean, your argument seems to ignore paragraph C of section 5-413, which says the court acting in the best interest of the person subject to conservatorship may decline to appoint a person having priority and appoint a person having a lower priority or no priority. That seems to give the district court discretion so long as there's a finding that it's in the best interest to do so. And isn't that what happened here?
I agree that that statute is accurately cited by the court. I agree that that does give the court, a trial court, an opportunity to appoint someone who isn't the priority appointment. However, the findings and the justification in this case were not present. And the court ignored it by saying, and justifying it by saying, simply because PFF threatened to not be guardian does not give the court a reason to ignore those priority appointments. In fact, the court didn't find Ms. Noon those priorities unacceptable. She's not disqualified to serve in any way, and she was willing and able to serve. And in addition, she was also the co-trustee of the trust where other significant assets were held. There was significant testimony about the trust and about Ms. Noon's understanding of the assets in the trust and her ability to manage and maintain those assets as well. So the court ignored those arguments that made Ms. Noon qualified simply to come to the conclusion it wished to get.
If I could jump in, Mr. Tillis, you keep saying the court ignored evidence, the court ignored the statute. I think that might be too strong a word. And so I want to ask a question about the evidence here. When the district court is faced with, say, let's say, conflicting evidence, and decides to credit some evidence that is contrary to your position, is that what you mean when you say the court ignored evidence? Is it the court ignored the evidence you wanted the court to focus on and instead credited evidence that that you didn't think was true?
No, and I'll explain. I think there's two answers to your question. Number one, the court did not, when I use the word ignore, I'm referring to findings the court did not make regarding the priorities and the willingness of Ms. Noon to serve. And I think the court ignored some of that, including her ability to serve as a co-trustee. But to answer the other part of your question, no. When I use the word ignore, I'm not suggesting that if they make findings we're unhappy with that they ignored it. I think we disagree with those, but they would have made findings and would have not ignored those arguments. But we think those findings would be incorrect.
So let me be more specific. When the court says that it has left the fact that Noon blocked Yeager's phone number left the district court not confident in the sustainability of Noon as Yeager's conservator. So the court is there making a determination about the sustainability of Noon and saying, based on this relationship, it's not confident that that is in the best interest. And it's doing that specifically to fulfill the paragraph that Judge Johnson stated in subsection C. So the question I have is, do you think that the court, in making that determination and saying it's not confident, is that ignoring the law? Is that ignoring the evidence?
No, it is, but it is not properly balancing that evidence with the other testimony.
It appears there are no further questions for you, Mr. Toulouse. And if so, then you will have an opportunity for rebuttal after respondent's argument. Counsel for respondent, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Lily Sackett. I'm here on behalf of Wadena County, and there is a prior determination that PFF would also be a respondent in this matter, so I'm here on behalf of PFF as well. There appear to be two issues. The first one is that there's the argument that PFF was improperly appointed because of priority. The district court did not ignore priority statutes, as I believe it was pointed out before under Minnesota Statute 524.5-413, subsection C. The court is allowed in their discretion to appoint someone with lower priority or no priority if they believe that it would be in the best interests of the respondent. In this case, Ms. Yeager. And I believe that the court did find that it would be in the best interests of Ms. Yeager to have PFF be appointed. It was not just because PFF would not be willing to serve as the guardian if they weren't appointed as the conservator, though that was certainly one of the things that was mentioned, but also because they did not have confidence that Ms. Noon would be able to work with Ms. Yeager to be a good conservator. They've had many problems in the past being able to communicate. Ms. Noon has blocked Ms. Yeager's phone in the past. She is often described, Ms. Yeager, as being secretive, difficult, abusive. And so I think that the district court clearly saw that there was a high potential for continuing conflict, as was generally the norm between those two people.
What do we make of the fact that Ms. Noon testified that she was willing to serve as the conservator, and that at least appeared, or it was represented, that past problems may have at least calmed themselves for the time being? to what extent is the district court obligated to consider those circumstances?
Yes, well, perhaps she was trying to indicate that things had calmed down to an extent, but she didn't just have, you know, a brief moment of not being able to speak with Ms. Yeager. It was an ongoing problem. She adamantly refused to be appointed the guardian because Ms. Yeager was being so difficult. So it's a bit hard to see how saying, no, she's too difficult, I can't work with her, I can't be the guardian, but I'm fine with being the conservator. I would say those two things don't necessarily mesh. And I think that the district court understood that to be a conservator, you still need to be able to communicate with the person. You still need to be able to understand their wants and desires and what would be best for them. And it's very difficult to decide what is going to be best for them, financially speaking, if you can't have a good conversation. And their conversations over the years were off and on and off and on. So I think that the fact that she was completely unwilling to be the guardian was very telling that being the conservator probably wouldn't be a very good choice for probably Ms. Noon or Ms. Yeager and their relationship. So as I was saying, they also addressed the issue that the estate was fairly complicated. And Ms. Noon did testify that there were several properties, but it wasn't, no exhaustive list was ever provided. In the findings of fact, the district court says, well, there it contains at least six properties, but even the district court at that point wasn't entirely sure exactly how many properties there were because no exact list was really provided. It was more like, oh, there's a property here, there's a property here. It wasn't very well fleshed out. And Ms. Noon, I mean, she testified that, okay, she was aware that they were there, but all she ever did was cursory drive-by looks at the property. She didn't have a very good idea of the exact states of all the properties. She hadn't done walkthroughs of the property. And I don't think it is denied that Ms. Yeager's estate is very complex. I mean, whoever is the conservator, PFF in this case, they will have to hire several professionals to get the property ready for sale or selling off virgin timber. They have to look at contracts. It's probably more than Ms. Noon could handle. And I believe that was one of the concerns of the district court. So it wasn't just that she also needed a guardian, although that was not an improper finding either. As a practical matter, Ms. Yeager, the district court strongly believed that Ms. Yeager needed a guardian and a conservator. They can't compel PFF to say, okay, we'll just be the guardians. PFF doesn't have to accept that appointment. And if PFF did not accept the appointment as the conservator, they weren't going to be the guardian either. So it was in Ms. Yeager's best interests to have PFF appointed as both because she did need a guardian. And PFF was the only party who was willing to fill that role. I know it was mentioned that maybe Ms. Noon would be the guardian if no one else was available, but she stated several times that she was just not willing to take on that responsibility. There's also the
Ms. Sackett. Yes. Do you agree that the appointment of PFF as custodian has no effect on the trust and or trust assets?
PFF would not automatically be appointed as the trustee. That is true. However, Ms. Yeager does have substantial liquid assets. I believe she has about $6,000 coming in from Social Security alone. And it's also not testified to exactly which properties are or are not in the trust. I believe at least some of them were not in the trust at that point. So while significant assets were certainly in the trust, there are also significant assets, liquid and otherwise, that were not in the trust and definitely in need of management.
So after the district court's order, Ms. Noon retains whatever powers of whatever trustee authority she was given by the trust agreement?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's correct. So the other issue, of course, is if least restrictive alternatives were ignored. I don't believe that they were. The district court considered that there was a trust in place and that there was a power of attorney, but they also cited that these things hadn't assisted Ms. Yeager in the past. So, for example, she owed quite a bit of money to her care facility that was going unpaid. The care facility actually reached out to Ms. Noon, said, hey, we have this problem. Our bill isn't going to be paid, and we're going to have to, you know, try to get that money somehow or evict her. And Ms. Noon was unable to help them. She basically said, well, she's too difficult. I can't do it. I'm sorry, I can't help you. So I don't see how a power of attorney would be a viable alternative when it hadn't been, which was basically what the district court said. I believe at the time of the hearing, there was still some money owing, and I believe that they did not know exactly how much. The court also did cite this Ms. Jager's testimony regarding those payments and the bills was so inconsistent that they did not actually find it credible. So to summarize, less restrictive alternatives, they weren't ignored. They just weren't applicable here. They weren't going to give Ms. Jager the adequate protection that she needed. And the least restrictive alternative here was, in fact, a conservatorship. And I believe that concludes my argument.
If there are no further questions, then we will turn to appellate's counsel for rebuttal. And it appears that there are none. Thank you, Ms. Sackett. Counsel for appellate, Mr. Toulouse, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument.
Thank you. I'll be fairly brief. I'm only going to address the things in the argument that I think were misstated. And I will not go back to what I said before, but if the court reviews the trial transcript, it will find that in fact, the properties were well flushed out. The ownership of those properties were well flushed out during trial, both by the ward and by Ms. Noon. Ms. Noon testified to with understanding of the properties, where the properties were located. And I don't believe that if there was a finding that she didn't understand the properties, that's accurate. I think it's in completely contrast to the testimony she gave.
The properties comprise one fairly significant portion of the estate, but there's also other findings which would indicate that Ms. Noon was not completely apprised of the scope of the estate. For example, in paragraph 28, and this is consistent with the trial testimony as I reviewed the transcript, and that is Ms. Noon was aware that mom had a lot of debt, but she didn't know where that debt was. She had no idea as to the scope of the debt. So, I mean, is that a fair finding? Is that an accurate finding?
That is an accurate finding, correct. It's also also regarding those, Ms. Noon testified extensively that she knew about Ms. Jager's income as well. She knew she received Social Security. She knew the income she received from the farm. She knew her sources of income. So, she did not.
But she did not know the amounts, though.
No, she did not. She did not. That's correct. There's also.
Before you move on, in terms of the debt, did she know how much was outstanding to Fair Oaks? The Noon. I should be specific. I'll ask a follow up about the other she. But for now, let's just talk about Noon. Does the transcript in your view, or the record in your view, show that Ms. Noon knew the total amount outstanding?
I believe it does. I believe it was discussed with Ms. Noon, but the trial transcript will show that the ward herself knew that there was no money owed. And it's a mischaracterization of the evidence that there was any money owed to Fair Oaks. And the trial transcript will show, interestingly, that when the representative from Social Services was asked about that, She had no understanding that Fair Oaks bill had actually been paid in full. Further, and very important, is the fact that the person who testified on behalf of Fair Oaks had no knowledge that Ms. Jagger had paid that bill in full prior to the trial. So the one person who was able to testify about that was Ms. Jagger herself, and she testified that she had paid the bill in full. And ironically, the person representing Fair Oaks had no idea.
So the person representing Fair Oaks testified as well. And right. Did that person testify that the balance was zero or that there was still money owed?
She had no idea what the balance was. She didn't have any understanding.
What did she testify to, Mr. Toulouse?
That someone else took care of that.
She didn't testify that the remaining balance was $89,000, that there was only a single payment of $22,000, that was made prior to the hearing, and that there was a second check made out but never given to the facility.
Okay. If she testified to that, I believe that was what she believed, but that was incorrect, and it was contradicted by Ms. Jagger. And in fact, a check was paid to Fair Oaks, and there was no money owed. The bill was paid in full. As it relates briefly to Ms. Noon and the things that she had already done a number of those roles and had started to do that. She was involved trying to help Fair Oaks negotiate that and work with them. She did testify that she knew about her income. She did testify that she had done what she could regarding the properties in the trust. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toulouse. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That concludes our oral argument, this panel's oral argument for today. So we are now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.